Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, you've been hearing us talk about it, and this morning we're going to open hearing more about how the 31st annual Bowl to Benefit, the Umbrella Center for Domestic and Violence Services, plays a critical role in providing community programs serving more than 6,000 domestic violence victims and their children every year here in Connecticut. Then it's time for part three of our Heart Month Survival Guide. What would you do if a loved one thought they were having a heart attack? How could you help someone suffering cardiac arrest? And what should you expect from emergency responders and emergency room staff once a heart attack sufferer reaches the hospital? We'll answer all these and more questions with a cardiac specialist from Waterbury Hospital, so stay tuned. You may save a life. Then we'll sit down with the director of the Greater Bridgeport's Council of Churches Food Equity and Economic Development Center to learn about innovative ways they are doing so much more than just feeding the hungry by matching individuals and systems to resources throughout the Park City's faith-based organizations to create jobs, new businesses, and a healthier, more sustainable community. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Organicon is coming. That's right. Join Connecticut NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association, for Organicon, its 37th annual winter conference, the largest gathering of organic farming and food enthusiasts in Connecticut. Enjoy a wide array of workshops, great gift and farm goods shopping, food trucks for breakfast and lunch, as well as a keynote talking about organic seed development. This event is very popular, and it's happening February 23rd at Housatonic Community College in Bridgeport from 8 to 5. Learn more and register at organicon.squarespace.com or just visit ctnofa.org and learn about everything NOFA is doing right here in Connecticut. Well, if you've been listening to the award-winning For the People, if you started listening, I should say, as recently as around this time last year, or at any point in the other 27-plus years that I've been handling this program, you have been hearing around this time of year about the Bowl to Benefit. As a matter of fact, we've already been asking you to lace up your bowling shoes and polish up your bowling ball and start practicing, because the 31st annual Bowl to Benefit, the Umbrella Center for Domestic and Violence Services, is coming up Sunday, March 3rd at Bolero, the former AMF Lanes in Milford. We want you to be thinking about informing your team now, getting your reservations in, and be among the hundreds and hundreds of bowlers that are coming out to support the Umbrella. You can play a role in providing community programs servicing more than 6,000 domestic violence victims and their children every year in Connecticut. We're going to visit with Julie Johnson. She is with BH Care. She's the project coordinator for the Family Justice Center at the Umbrella Center for Domestic and Violence Services. And Julie, thank you for joining us on the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
So first of all, there's a few moving parts here that we want to kind of align in people's minds as they're listening early on this Sunday morning, starting with BH Care, which is sort of the overarching human services agency under which the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services is just one component, right?
Yes, so BH Care has many different programs, and they have programs that deal with mental health and addiction. They have the Umbrella Center, which is for domestic violence services. They have prevention services, and they also have children's services at PCRC. So there's many. So the BH Care is like the governing agency for all those social service providers, including the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services.
Yeah, so I think going back my 27 or 28 years of the 31 that the Bowl-a-thon, which is how it started, now the Bowl to Benefit, has sort of evolved. The Umbrella was part of an organization called Birmingham Group Health Services or something like that, and that has eventually come under the larger overseeing presence of BH Care, and as a result, both the constituents that you serve and the geographical region has expanded greatly from the first few early bulletins that were just basically serving people in, like, from maybe Naugatuck Beacon Falls down to Shelton along the in the communities
right,
beside
in the
Naugatuck River. Now you guys, 6,000 plus folks you're servicing every year with the umbrella.
Yep, so the Umbrella Center services from the valley to the shoreline. So it encompasses about 19 towns in its catchment area. So, yeah, so they're providing services, you know, to over, like you said, over 6,000 people a year and their children. And so it's really a far-grasping program. And I think that, you know, having the other programs linked through BH Care is also, a great asset for the Umbrella Center.
Yeah, I think, folks tend to compartmentalize a little bit when they're thinking of domestic violence and family violence victims and folks who may be homeless or folks who may be experiencing mental health challenges or, even folks who may not be able to afford regular health services who seek provision or facilitation or referral to those services through BH Care. But in fact, that synergy among all of the branches of BH Care probably really helps identify and get a lot more domestic violence victims connected with Umbrella and the help that they need.
Yeah, and that's kind of where the Family Justice Center initiative kind of came about across the country. It started in California, but is that, you know, when you're servicing or, you know, you're providing services to people, it's not just, you can't just silo, you know, what they would need. So you think it's just domestic violence, they may just need, you know, advocacy and something like that. But a lot of times the services they need overlap in so many different ways. And that is what really the concept of the Family Justice Center is that instead of sending your victim to all these different service agencies because they could need, you know, housing assistance, they could need restraining order assistance, they could need child care advocacy, they could need all these different programs. And so the Family Justice Center concept is let's embrace that and knowing that to get all these providers that are already providing services, you know, great services to the same victims. Let's get them all under one roof. And that's the concept. So instead of sending them out to all these different appointments, they're still referring them to those agencies, but those agencies will have a representative at the Family Justice Center. Mm. So it will be, you know, we like to say one-stop shopping for, you know, someone who needs all these different services. And instead of going from place to place, they'll do it in one spot because what we know is that oftentimes they may become frustrated with the system. They may, you know, may not have the availability to go to all these different appointments and places and may not have transportation and, you know, so many different obstacles. And a lot of times that the result is that they become frustrated and may stop going, to these appointments. And so, you know, we're hoping that, you know, although we already see 6,000 people a year, you know, that our number is going to go up because people feel more comfortable. People continue to come seek the services. And ultimately, the ultimate goal is that people and victims are safer because they are wrapped in services.
Mm. I'm just thinking back. It had to be at least or around 15 years ago when a counterpart of yours with Umbrella and I were interviewing, and they were talking about this incredible new concept that they were excited to be launching at the court down in Derby, where they were actually going to have a liaison or a caseworker
right,
embedded in the institutional judicial setting in order to sort of help the victims navigate just that piece of it. And then right around the same time or a couple of years later, then it was this huge movement to begin to meld law enforcement into the pattern, and how they were starting to work so much more closely and play such a more important role in helping facilitate the connection between the victims they're meeting on the front lines and the services that Umbrella provided. This really not only seems to be part, this the Family Justice Center not only seems to be part of this natural evolution, but it really seems to, as you have said, taken a West Coast concept that has slowly moved eastward and really kind of supersized it, as you say, to kind of wrap many different agencies at many different times in the process that the victim has to go through with, certain points, high points of services.
Right. Yeah, and I think that, as the time goes by, you kind of evolve. And 15 years ago, now that's state law. There has to be a victim advocate in the court, in every court. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of move forward. What else can we do to make it better for victims? And, who else can we involve in this? And so we've never, we don't keep the blinders on. We don't say, okay, we only want this type of partner, because sometimes you get, a client come in and you're like, oh my goodness, I've never had someone who needed this type of service, And so you kind of are like, we're open to partnering with anyone who wants to provide services to victims, whose agency is a nonprofit that provides free services to victims. And so that's where we're working towards. And we already have so many agencies that have pledge support and to be partners of the Family Justice Center.
Mm. And you're really kind of on the cutting edge of a new movement here, at least in Connecticut. You're just one of a few or a couple of Family Justice Centers that are now operating in the state.
Yes. So the only other Family Justice Center in Connecticut is the Center for Family Justice in Bridgeport. Mm-hmm. And so I know there are a couple other communities like ourselves who are beginning the development phase. So we're hoping that in the next month or two, we have a temporary location. The city of New Haven has provided us with a temporary location at 316 Dixwell Avenue. Mm-hmm. And so we're there Tuesdays and Fridays from 10 to 2. And like I said, it is a temporary location. But we are, essentially up and running. But in the next couple of months, we hope to have our own space for the Family Justice Center to have an opening.
Great.
A full opening. Yeah.
And for people who may be listening on one of our stations in another mm-hmm. region of the state, can you just let folks that are listening know how or when they could come to the Family Justice Center for resources that you offer, or anything else that they might need to know about providing support so that the Family Justice Center can more effectively grow and eventually occupy your own permanent space?
Sure. First off, if anyone does need services in any way, they can call the hotline number. And so it's a crisis hotline, but it's also for people who aren't in crisis, where they can get information that they need and get pointed. If they're not in our catchment area, they could get pointed in the right direction for their local domestic violence provider.
Mm-hmm.
Those numbers, I'll give you, it's 203-736-9944 or 203-789-8104.
Okay.
And there's also a toll-free number. It's 888-774-2900. But if they were to, let's say they wanted to get involved in the Family Justice Center project,
mm-hmm.
With either being on a committee or being, just wanting to know more about the Family Justice Center, then they can certainly, they could call. My direct line is 203-780-2033, and they could certainly call that number. And they could also go on bhcare.org,
mm-hmm.
On the website, the main website, and you could go to services, and then under services is our domestic violence, and then we're listed as the Hope Family Justice Center.
Very good.
And then from the website. And so they could either find out more information, they could also donate on that website.
Very good. And before we let you go, the big injection of financial support in great part comes through this long and traditional annual fundraising effort that is also a lot of fun for folks who come out to really support this very serious initiative, the Bowl to Benefit, which we talked about briefly in the introduction, 31 years strong and happening for so many years at the AMF Lanes, now Bowlero in Milford. So, Julie Johnson, before we let you go, just hit the folks one more time with the information about the Bowl to Benefit.
Sure. Yeah, so the Bowl to Benefit, like you said, is the 31st annual, and it's at Bowlero in Milford. It's Sunday, March 3rd. And so there's four different bowling sessions. And so bowlers could sign up to bowl, get four or five bowlers to go with them. It's a $10 per bowler registration fee. And then you're asked to get, $50 in pledges from your friends and family for that. The four sessions are at 11:30, at 2, 4:30, and 7. And with your registration, you get 90 minutes of bowling. There's, some raffles and events and shoe rentals and soft drinks. And it's a really great event. It's really fun to get, a group of friends together, go down and bowl for a really important cause. And so all proceeds that are raised go to the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services.
And the other cool thing is that there's a lot of folks there from BH Care and Umbrella, including a bunch of other volunteers and even some clients and former clients. So there's a lot of opportunity at every one of the four bowling sessions, no matter where you are in the lanes with your group bowling, for folks that are directly impacted or passionate about the cause to walk up on and get friendly with all the bowlers. So there's a lot of opportunities to learn more about the Umbrella and BH Care and what's going on with all of the efforts that the Umbrella Center for Domestic and Violence Services is doing. So you can have some fun for the serious cause. You can learn a lot. And hopefully, if you haven't already, develop a relationship that's ongoing with the Umbrella Center at BH Care and possibly even focus some fundraising or other efforts toward continuing the support of this second Family Justice Center here in Connecticut. Julie mm-hmm. Johnson is the project coordinator for the Family Justice Center at the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services. And we thank you for being with us this morning, Julie, and we'll see you out at Bowlero in Milford on Sunday, March 3rd for the 31st annual Bowl to Benefit the Umbrella Center. So thanks for being part of the show this morning, and we'll see you at the bowling alley.
Well, we have brought our mobile rig up to Waterbury for the next installment of our Heart Month Survival Guide, and we're pleased to meet for the first time Dr. Asim Nikala. He's a cardiology specialist affiliated with Waterbury Hospital. We walked into his building this morning just to see his smiling face all over the place, billboards and flyers and things. So I feel I know him already. So, Doctor, thank you for joining us this morning. So let's start our conversation with a really basic question, because people say they had a heart attack, but that really is quite oversimplifying things, because if I understand correctly, there are a myriad situations that could kind of fall under that loose label of heart attack, right?
Right. First, thank you for coming, and thank you for this opportunity. So heart attack has another name. It's called acute coronary syndrome. That might sound like a fancy name, but it actually means as it sounds. Coronary arteries are the three major arteries that supply your heart, two on the left and one on the right. Heart attacks means that there is an acute ischemic situation where your heart is not getting enough blood supply and oxygen. Every cell in our body counts on oxygen for survival. When there is acute, complete, or partial cessation of this blood flow in any of these arteries, you get the symptoms of heart attack. There is three major kinds of heart attacks, one that can actually cause damage into your heart muscle, and the other two might not cause so much damage, yet you get still the symptoms, same symptoms. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the symptoms, because it's broad. Anything that you feel between your umbilicus and your mandible, lower half of your jaw, can be from your heart. This being said, there is other organs that can give you chest pain or other symptoms in this chestal area. Unfortunately, there is no good way to tell whether you're having a heart attack or just bad indigestion or mild random inflammation in your lung sac or even the heart sac, which is much milder problems compared to heart attack. This is why if you feel that you're having a heart attack or if you're having any of these symptoms, you should immediately seek medical help. Now, what are these symptoms? Traditionally, chest pain has been the most common presenting symptoms for heart attack. This is typical for men younger than 80 years old. But when it comes to women, diabetic patients, and elderly men older than 80 years old, symptoms can be what we call atypical for acute coronary syndrome or heart attack, like acute shortness of breath, out of nowhere, you're short of breath, indigestion, vague, dull chest discomfort, chest heaviness, shoulder pain, elbow pain, left arm numbness. All of these symptoms can be due to a heart attack, and you should not ignore your symptoms. And again, there's no good way to tell. The emergency room physician and the cardiologist are the ones who are able to do more physical examination, more testing, to be able to distinguish whether this is a heart attack that requires further attention or no. So the first thing you do, if you or a loved one or a family member is experiencing any of these symptoms with no risk factors for coronary artery disease, is one, to call emergency medical service, two, to try to take 4 doses of baby aspirin, chew them, swallow them with a cup of water. This will provide some protection, some coverage until you are further evaluated in an acute care setting.
So let me stop you there and just jump back a little bit to the three types of heart attack that somebody could experience, just to educate the listeners a little bit more, along with the practical advice that you have been and will continue to talk about. Is it true that one of them is like an electrical disturbance?
That's a good question. The three kinds of heart attacks depends on how much blood flow you are still getting from this diseased artery. If there is complete cessation and blockage of this artery, that is one kind of heart attack that needs to be treated emergently with cardiac cath and stent placement. The two other heart attacks, there will be partial obstruction of that artery. There still will be blood flow, not enough to make you asymptomatic or feeling fine at baseline, enough to produce symptoms, but maybe not enough to cause damage as of yet. If ignored, can lead to the same consequences of the type 1 or the first type of heart attacks.
And has science revealed why the symptoms of heart attacks in men are different than heart attacks in women? And why do we hear that heart attacks in women are so much more insidious or masked? My understanding is that, unfortunately, I guess a lot more women just don't automatically go there in their head in certain situations when they're feeling, you know, pain or other symptoms. There's just the connection to a heart attack and calling 911. I understand is just, you know, not always there.
That's true. And yes, there is some evidence that women often misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed with coronary artery disease or heart attacks. And I think it's cultural in the most part. Women think that they are kind of protected against heart attacks or experience less heart attacks less frequently. This is not true, especially if a female is postmenopausal, meaning after she does not get period monthly. Mm-hmm. So this is why any symptoms should be respected, typical or atypical. The outcome of heart attacks does not differ between men, women. There is more better outcomes if you are younger, if you have less comorbidities, especially diabetes, high blood pressure, and other stuff. But yes, women after a certain age get same exact percentage of heart attacks as men.
And so there's a difference if someone is by themselves and they're having symptoms that they think is a heart attack. Obviously, if they are conscious and able, they call 911 and then go into that process, which we'll discuss briefly. But hear in news articles and see on social media, if you think you're having a heart attack, you have to cough very as hard as you can several times, or possibly even, you know, thump on your chest yourself manually. Are those myths, or could those have a positive impact if you are having a heart attack?
Well, I'm glad that you asked this question, because if anything, those are very harmful maneuvers. For one thing, coughing or trying to relieve your symptoms might give you some mental relief without actual problem solution. Hitting your chest might actually generate enough electricity to add to the problem and even cause cardiac arrest. So there is no home maneuver that can help you with if you're having a heart attack, other than taking aspirin and calling emergency service as soon as possible.
So it is really, even if people are long past the time when they have a baby around the house, baby aspirin is probably a component that everyone should have in their home medicine cabinet or first aid kit, even in the vehicle?
Yes, absolutely. Comes to that would be an AED or a defibrillator, which my understanding...
Much more expensive than a bottle of baby aspirin.
That is true, but it's totally worth it. I don't ask everyone to have an AED in their houses, but at least to locate one in your neighborhood, if you work in your workplace. And more importantly, it's very important to get certified in CPR. Everyone is invited to do so by the American Heart Association. Mm. It can save a life.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about that after the break. But right now, we are going to take a few moments. We're with Dr. Asim Nikala at Waterbury Hospital. He's a cardiology specialist. We're actually here at his office in Waterbury. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about what you're going to need to know if you're calling 911, and that incredibly important time between when you make the recognition that you may be having a heart attack and you're actually in the ER and being treated by a full service team of physicians with all the pharmacology and equipment that you need. So we'll be back with Dr. Nikala in just a moment.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. Hey, and if you work with or volunteer for a nonprofit, stay tuned. Our Love CT 2019 grant opportunities will be opening soon. This is Director of Public Affairs John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Come on up to Northern Litchfield County and celebrate a winter weekend festival in Norfolk. 2 days of fun for all, indoors and out. Food, live music, art exhibits, winter sports and hiking, tours, open houses, kids activities, so much going on. Take a wildlife walk, learn about curling, and try it yourself. View breathtaking stained glass windows, check out the mini maker space, or just lace up your skates for a few turns around the rink. Virtually all the activities are free. So learn more and make plans by visiting weekendinnorfolk.org.
Thanks for sticking with us. We're with Dr. Asim Nikala, a cardiology specialist affiliated with Waterbury Hospital, here during our Heart Month Survival Guide segment in February, which is Heart Month. We've already gotten some really, really important advice from the doctor about symptoms and how you can best help yourself or get help if you think you're having a heart attack. Doctor, let's go to bystanders, because a lot of times heart attacks immobilize the victim. If a bystander comes upon someone who is unconscious or maybe gripping their chest or saying that they think they're having a heart attack, you mentioned CPR before we took the break. Obviously, this is really important, and it's so interesting that just a week or two ago, you should probably heard the story, somebody was able to render CPR to a person who was suffering a heart attack and actually apparently prevented that person from dying because they saw how to do CPR on a television program. They never took CPR, but they were able to do it because they remembered that on the TV show The Office, when they had CPR training on the TV show, the instruction was, pump the chest to the tune of the Bee Gees' Stayin' Alive. So that's what the person did, and they ended up apparently saving the victim. While this is kind of a lighthearted story, it's pretty darn serious if you have a heart attack. So what should bystanders do if they come upon somebody and they're either unconscious or saying that they have a heart attack?
Well, first of all, try to ask the patient what are their symptoms and make sure that they are conscious and establish a conversation. Then the very next step is to call emergency service, and they will ask you about these couple things. Is the patient with you conscious, able to talk, communicate his symptoms or no? Then, again, locate an AED or a defibrillator, automated defibrillator. Why? Because a lot of heart attacks would be massive enough to cause cardiac arrest or significant/fatal arrhythmia. The heart can beat too fast or too slow or stop completely as being suffering from a heart attack. This is a reversible condition, but this patient will depend on you as a bystander. Mm-hmm. If you are able to start CPR or use EED, then you might save his life or her life mm-hmm. until he or she is seen at the emergency room. So, yes, it's very important to do so.
Older folks that may be listening may, who have obviously had no experience with this kind of thing, may just think back in the day, you called 911, you talked to an operator, and they sent help as soon as possible. We're here in Waterbury, where the fire department responds to medical emergencies, and with the location of the firehouses, the response time is actually excellent, if I understand correctly. Sure. But could you talk a little bit about the important role that the emergency dispatcher today plays in a, especially like a heart attack situation? Because they're a vital component of the caregiving team as soon as they pick up that emergency call, right?
That's absolutely true. As they say in the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology Foundation, time is muscle. The heart is always described as a muscle because it's a muscle. Time is muscle means from the moment you feel your symptoms until you get treated, and we'll talk about various treatments for heart attacks, there is a certain time frame or window of opportunity. Beyond that, the benefit is much less. Actually, there is higher mortality if we do not utilize this time frame or window. And this is why when you call emergency service, you need to have answers to these questions because in their mind, they know what to expect. Once they arrive, they will first make sure that the patient is still conscious. They will ask about their symptom. They will do an EKG, 12-lead EKG, also known as ECG, same thing. Mm-hmm. This will tell them whether a patient is having a heart attack for sure or no. Sometimes it's vague, but if there is any suspicion, they will take the patient to a PCI facility. PCI stands for percutaneous coronary intervention, which is what we do in the cardiac cath lab. Once a patient is identified to have an acute heart attack, he will be emergently transferred to a hospital that is capable of PCI. Mm-hmm. And we take it from there. We do the PCI, and we can talk about this.
Sure. The other thing that's important, I think, to stress is maybe not if someone just comes upon somebody on the street, but if somebody's with a loved one, a child, a parent, husband or wife, when the EMTs and paramedics or firefighters or police officers get to the scene, a lot of times the loved one may be very, very anxious to see the person who's suffering get into an ambulance, into the hospital as fast as possible. But in fact, as you pointed out with the dispatcher, also obviously with the emergency responders, they are also part of that treatment team, and critically important work happens on the scene. So if you could just stress to folks, if they can even remember it in that hot white moment of panic, that they really need to let the emergency treatment interveners do their work. And it may seem like it takes a lifetime before that individual is rolling toward the hospital, but they're doing important work.
Yes, that's true. Make sure to have medication list ready, allergies, other medical problems your family member or loved one might have or had in the past, procedures, prior surgeries, problems with the musculoskeletal system if they needed to intubate this person on site, for example. Do they have a mandible problem? Do they have a neck injury in the past? Anything like that will be very helpful. Why? Because emergency service not only transfer patients to the hospital, they actually, the first responders, and that implies they actually do treatment. They are the first ones who give treatment. And this treatment can be in the form of medications, device therapy, infusions, or even CPR if needed. So it's very important to allow them to do what they have to do. Don't ask them questions. Just answer their question, because time is very, very sensitive at this point. And what you can do is just provide information as much as you can. One important thing, our EMS in Waterbury is impressive. Do not follow the emergency vehicle. That's a safety point I would like to emphasize.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very good. And finally, as you prompted a few moments ago, once they arrive at the hospital and they will be getting continual care and possibly even dispatching critical information to the hospital by radio or by some other means on the way. But once they get to the hospital, you mentioned there might be various types of intervention depending on the type of heart attack it is.
That's true. We get the EKG that is done by EMS on site. We get it faxed. We get a report from the dispatcher. So the emergency room physician and the cardiologist on call will be ready for the patient even before he or she arrive. Once the patient is here, we already have an idea about what's going on. If this patient needs cardiac cath lab, we activate the cath lab even before the patient is here. After hours, we call the team in, and the team most of the time is in the hospital physically before the patient arrives and ready for him, because, again, time is muscle. When I say this, there is a magic number, actually. The first kind of heart attack needs intervention in the cath lab within 90 minutes from the onset of symptoms to the completion of the procedure. Beyond those 90 minutes frame of time, the outcomes are not as favorable. There's still some benefits, but not as if you do intervention within 90 minutes. Sometimes there is chest pain that is convincing for a heart attack. A person comes, everybody will be ready for him or her, and turns out not to be a heart attack. There is so other things and organs in your chest that can give you symptoms that are similar to heart attack. And this will be further evaluated, of course, in the hospital once we rule out the major, major problem, which is heart attack.
And when in doubt, call 911, even if you think it's the bad omelet you just ate.
Absolutely, no doubt. Do not hesitate to do so, because this might be the one life-saving approach you do.
Dr. Issam Nakala is a cardiology specialist affiliated with Waterbury Hospital. He was kind enough to give us quite a lot of time today here during February, which is Heart Month, and to be part of our multi-segment special report, our Heart Month Survival Guide. Dr. Nakala, thank you. Very great to meet you, and thank you for all this potentially life-saving advice.
Thank you very much.
Well, we are on the road this morning to Lower Fairfield County and stopping in with the Council of Churches of Greater Bridgeport and happy to be the guest of Michelle McCabe. She's the director of the Center for Food Equity and Economic Development for the Council. And we've got a lot to talk about this morning in relation to what Michelle is doing in regards to hunger and nutrition and the utilization of food, not only for personal sustenance, but for economic relief. Lots to talk about this morning, but let's do a little bit of an overview, Michelle, on exactly what you do and how that fits into the greater mission of the council.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to have this opportunity to speak with you. So the Council of Churches has been involved in addressing food insecurity for many decades. And most of us are very aware of what that might look like if you have ever had a food drive at your school or your religious organization, or if you've ever volunteered at a soup kitchen or a food pantry. That's the work that the council has been doing for a long time, which is supporting these agencies and getting food out to people who need it. But in the last 5 years that I've been working in this role, we've come to realize that, one, the issue has gone beyond hunger, certainly here in Connecticut. And what I mean by that is, at this moment, we just had a study that was released by the United Way, and it demonstrated that in Connecticut, 40% of residents do not make enough to meet their basic needs. And what that means is that there is chronic food insecurity among a lot of people that live here, because food, of course, is a basic need. And so the question has to be, since we're not solving what is more of a temporary problem, like hunger is, you know, you feel hungry, you go eat, and then you're not hungry anymore. That's not the situation that we're addressing now. It's how do we allow for a consistent stream of health-supportive foods get into people's pantries and refrigerators? And also, how does this system help people gain the financial stability that they need in order to emerge from a state of poverty into a state, again, of stability? Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of ways that food can do that. So these were the questions that the council and then, in particular, our program, the Feed Center, started contemplating. How can we use this material that's food, that's donated, that in some cases would otherwise be thrown away? How can we use that to actually address the economic issues that were the source of food insecurity for people? So we ended up doing that through a number of different program initiatives. The first among them was a culinary training program, which we've been operating since 2016. Where we train area residents in culinary skills, workplace skills, and ServSafe, which is the industry standard for food safety, mm-hmm. and then help them find either food industry employment or launch their own food business. The next thing that we did was try to utilize the church kitchens for commercial use. So we had these spaces that were laying empty for much of the time, and we wanted to make those available, in particular to these very same residents that are having to utilize food pantries as a way to boost food entrepreneurship in the area. So we offer these kitchens for rent at a very reduced rate, and coupled with our culinary training, we're there to shepherd people through what they need to do to form a food business. And then finally, we launched our own food business, a social enterprise that's used as both a food business incubator that we help area residents get an immersive experience in how to start a business. And we're making product using recovered produce. So produce that would have otherwise been thrown away, we're using it in order to both support our programming and to support residents.
Great. Well, let's dig into each of those three components. And really, I mean, the one that's kind of most interesting to me in relation to your role in part for economic development is in the other ear and in the media, we're hearing about how for a lot of churches, no matter what the denomination is, attendance has been kind of trending down. People just don't go to church like they used to when we were younger. And a lot of these churches are looking for revenue streams to make up for that loss, donations given during service and such. The utilization of these commercial kitchens sounds like a brilliant development at just the right time, because not only are a lot of people who think of breaking out on their own thinking of doing something in the line of food service, baking, some sort of packaged meal delivery, restaurant, catering, what have you, but you have in many cases these well-equipped kitchens that may have been their usage is dwindling for activities at the churches themselves. So let's key in on that aspect first, and if you could give us a couple of examples of where individuals that have come to you are now having some productive usage and partnership with churches in the commercial kitchens.
Sure. So we have a number of entrepreneurs that are renting our current space. So right now we are renting out St. John's Episcopal Church in Bridgeport, their kitchen. So we're in partnership with them to provide that space to entrepreneurs. And we've had one entrepreneur who's making cookies that has just signed a contract to do wholesale work. Mm-hmm. So she went from, the usual beginning place is farmers market. So you'll have a food entrepreneur that comes in and they start producing and then they grow their business. And so this one particular entrepreneur, Pam's Cookies, is now going to be sold in stores. We have a caterer who I believe is just, I don't know the details of it, but is working with the Bridgeport Public Schools mm-hmm. with her product. Mm-hmm. And these are just two examples of some of our renters and how, if it wasn't for this kitchen being made available, they wouldn't have a lot of options for that entry-level space. There are larger commercial kitchens that are available for rent, but they are a bit cost prohibitive. And also they're bigger than what a first starting out business needs. So we're looking to be that first step, knowing that the best thing that could happen is that they graduate out because they're so successful, and then we get the next generation in. Mm-hmm. And to your point about congregations, I think the positive benefits for being in part of any group is the networking and the sense of community that they afford. Mm-hmm. And I think that churches and other religious groups certainly have a part to play in envisioning how they can be a vibrant part of a community, that it's spiritual on the one hand, but also it's just, like I said, being part of that community, and that community has a lot of things going on in it. One of the things that we've hoped to do, since the council has, I think it's 80 member congregations all around Fairfield County, that there are so many different ways that people can participate in helping their neighbor. It's not necessarily going back to the food drive example. You can do even one step further than that, is just to look at what you do in life and how can that be positively applied to someone else. So, for example, you might own a restaurant. And one of the ways that you can help in the work, for example, that we're doing is simply connecting some of our culinary graduates with employment opportunities. Or if you are a church renting out your kitchen, you're also potentially patronizing that business and helping them get their leg up so that they can be more successful. So it's a nice way to be invested, in your neighbors and in your town. So one of the other ones, like I had mentioned, is our culinary training, which in some ways is the heart and soul of the whole operation, because it's in those moments where we develop these really wonderful relationships with our partners in the community here in Bridgeport.
Is that being done exclusively at St. John's?
No, actually, that is operated out of Salem Lutheran Church, which is also in Bridgeport. So, yes, we're dividing our time between two church kitchens. And we're very grateful for their generosity in opening up their spaces to this work. So that is taking place at Salem. And we offer this class 3 times a year. It's a 10-week program. It's free for our residents to participate in. And in the course of those 10 weeks, they're there 4 days a week learning about basic culinary skills, food safety, and they have a number of guest speakers that talk about financial literacy and budgeting, licenses and permits that you need, and they talk to food entrepreneurs too that have successfully launched a business.
Mm. We also talked a little bit before we turned on the mic about an announcement by another organization that's going to be putting a mobile food pantry out in Greater Bridgeport and Fairfield County. This is something that is of a growing nature, fairly new. We're also hearing about small mobile farm markets and, of course, just the proliferation of farm markets and not just where they are, but when they are. Many going year-round now, many doing strategic partnerships in locations where they have the greatest propensity to draw the people who need them and want them most. But there's plenty of other opportunities for people, both in those worlds and in other aspects, like even working in food pantries, that can help to boost and sustain gainful employment.
Yes, absolutely. Some of the key ways that a food pantry certainly could help with that, and some of them do, especially food banks, is that they train people, for example, in warehousing or customer service or retail of some kind. I think the more that we can make these food distribution channels take into account the needs of the people they serve, the better. Mm-hmm. The way I look at it is this food is a resource, and the way that the food is handled now, there's a dynamic of the giver and the receiver. And we sort of dictate how that food is to be used. So, for example, excess food or food waste, however you want to refer to it.
It's uneaten food.
Uneaten food, but edible, I should say. Edible but uneaten food is a big problem. And in fact, it's one of the largest contributors to climate change is food that is in a landfill instead of having been eaten. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of things that we need to be doing to curb this practice. I mean, overproduction certainly being one of them. But because there's such a huge interest in this now, there are sort of two camps of people that are working with this resource because the food has value. It just hasn't been harnessed.
Mm. And apparently continues to be both nutritional and very tasty and usable even after a perceived shelf life expiration or when a few bruises or slightly wilting signs of age develop.
That's exactly right. And so some of it is how do we take advantage of these products before they are not good for anybody to eat anymore? There's a group of entrepreneurs that are taking advantage of this and looking at ways that they can make products to sell with this sort of second market of produce, for example, if we just want to stick with fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. But what's so interesting is that if you make when these fruits and vegetables make it to a low-income population, they're only really allowed to eat it. In other words, they can't take advantage of the same opportunities for inexpensive or free produce and convert it into something that will actually help them achieve financial stability. Mm. It'll help them with their fixed costs, like rent and utilities. Mm. That's why food insecurity is so pervasive, because it's one of those costs that isn't fixed. If you are looking to save money, you might start skipping meals. And that is actually what happens a lot. Unfortunately, the same thing happens with medication. Mm. They'll skip getting a prescription. They have their pills to make it last longer. And as you can imagine, has an enormous impact on health. So somebody could take, for example, a case of apples, produce an apple bread or an apple cake out of it, sell it, and then be able to afford these other things that are needed. Or they're able to build savings so that if something happens, like a car breaks down, it doesn't tank the family's entire economic outlook, which is what happens now. You can imagine that if you don't have savings, which, as we learned in the recent government shutdown, some of the discussion that I think was really helpful was how few Americans have savings, you know, so that when something like this happens, they don't have reserves to help them get through that tough period. And certainly this population, as you can imagine, is even more endangered by that. Mm-hmm. So something like a flat tire could cause someone to lose a job, which could cause the financial fortunes of a family to be in distress. Mm-hmm. So To be able to take that case of apples, for example, and build savings with it, that will actually have a lasting impact on a family, even potentially more so than just trying to eat a case of apples before they go bad. Mm-hmm. So some of the work that we're trying to do is how do we make those opportunities available to people, not just from a retail perspective, but also how can we make food pantries part of this solution to building savings.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this initiative something that's unique to the Council of Churches of Greater Bridgeport, or is this something that is happening in its own little world, replicated across many of the municipalities or larger cities in Connecticut?
I would say certainly locally or in Connecticut. Hmm. We are unique in looking at food distribution in this way. Certainly, and what we see our role as sort of a thought partner to food pantries and soup kitchens and to the food banks, and start pushing the envelope on how can we use these systems to better serve people. Mm-hmm. I'm proud to say that when I started this work, health as an important component to the work was not a prevalent thought. But it has become so. We're seeing a lot more healthcare organizations get involved with food distribution agencies, a lot of attention that's brought to the fact that food insecurity is driving up the cost of delivering good healthcare, and how we can partner to address that. That is something that I'm happy to say is changing in that direction. I think we need to take it then to the next step, which is, let's allow people access to food pantries more often to get more food and to look at it as part of a comprehensive way to allow for financial stability for people. That is something that isn't really being done. You'll see a food pantry, for example, that might have other services attached to it. There might be caseworkers. There might be financial literacy. But no one is looking specifically at the food itself as a way to save money and improve financial outlook. And that's something that I think we're bringing that's unique to this area of work.
Excellent. If somebody hears something that resonates with them or that inspires them to want to do more themselves, is there somewhere they can go on the web to learn more about the work that you're doing here at the Council of Churches?
Yes, absolutely. Our website is ccgb.org. So that's Council Churches Greater Bridgeport.org. And all of our information is there, not just more about our programs and what we do, but certainly how to contact us. So we would love to have people come and participate with us and be our partners.
Great. A lot more exciting news coming out of this organization, folks, which we'll be able to talk about in another month or two. We'll be visiting with Michelle McCabe again and the Council of Churches of Greater Bridgeport. Michelle is the director of the Center for Food Equity and Economic Development at the Council. We appreciate taking the time with us to introduce this program. As we're reporting on hunger regularly, we'll be back to talk about some other new and exciting developments in the near future. Michelle, thanks for having us.
Great. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.